Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's the Supremes. That love is here, and now you're gone. But Supremes hit number one on this day in 1967, before any of my guests were even born. And you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. This is our monthly segment on If I Were Mayor of Baltimore. And we are going to talk about, what else can we talk about this week, given that the mayor gave her State of the City address. We're going to talk about what was in that address, what they thought of it immediately, and we'll hear some clips from her address and more. So we're joined in the studio by Catalina Byrd, a media consultant, political strategist, and commentator who's co-host of No Hooks for Hip Hop Chronicles here on WEAA. Good to have you back in the studio, Catalina.
Good morning.
Adam Jackson's with us, CEO of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Good to have you back, Adam.
Morning, Mark.
And Jessica Lewis is with us, housing organizer for the Right to Housing Alliance. Welcome, Jessica. Good to have you back in the studio.
Thank you.
And y'all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to me here at talkatsteinershow.org. Write to us at talkatsteinershow.org. Log on to the Facebook pages, which I'll try to check here. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. What did you think of the mayor's State of the City address? What would you be doing if you were giving that address, Jessica?
Oh, me first. Well, I thought that the tone of the address, I mean, there's a lot to talk about with the specifics of the address.
Which we'll do, yeah, in a moment.
But the overall tone, you know, it's a PR event. We can look up the statistics on what happened in the city. It's really an event to try to showcase, you know, steps that the mayor's office is taking to make Baltimore a better city. So the tone is very, you know, self-reverential. It's very like, look at what we've accomplished. Look at, you know, making a bigger deal out of things that look attractive. But the tone of it overall, something that struck me from the beginning was, you know, she said we're working hard to make Baltimore a better city, not just, you know, to attract new families, but for people who live here now. And throughout the address, didn't really hear a lot about what they're doing to help families that live here now. There was a lot of talk about attracting development, about attracting new economic development, but not, you know, one of the things that struck me as missing in that, particularly as a housing organizer, is a conversation about real policy changes, real things that were, you know, have been sort of big pieces of her campaign and her mayoral platform, such as the Journey Home, that have not been really moved on since,
right,
you know, 2008. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I know the Journey Home well because I sat on that Journey Home from its inception and then stopped going because I felt it was just a lot of talk and not a whole lot was happening, and that became boring and a waste of my time, mm-hmm, because we don't follow those things after we talk about them, as Jessica was alluding to. Catalina, your overall reaction here before we hit these clips.
It was interesting, but I was wondering what it would have sounded like had it been delivered on the day that it was originally scheduled for.
What do you mean?
It was supposed to be scheduled the day of Frank Conaway Sr.'s funeral, and she rescheduled it out of respect.
Right, yeah.
And what's transpired since then is Barbara Mikulski's retirement. And so I'm wondering, because it seemed to me to be in line with what we're talking about these last 2 weeks now, in that positioning her for a different seat. And I wonder if it was revised. That was my first thought.
Yeah, we'll get into that. We're going to do another show about what's going to happen in the Senate race and the other races surrounding it in the next week, so we can grab that one as well. Adam?
Well, I guess my general reaction kind of is summed up in three words, you know, mm-hmm, lackluster, uninspiring, and out of touch.
Whoa.
Say
that one more time. What did you say?
Lackluster, uninspiring, and out of touch.
Why do you say that?
Because, I mean, generally speaking, the problem I have with the mayor's, you know, when she talks about things like economic development, she talks about crime and those things, it's real evident that she's not in touch with the community, like what people are doing in Baltimore already and the things that we're doing to make Baltimore a better place. Mm-hmm. Like Jessica was saying, she's real self-reverential. She talks about the things that she's accomplished, the things that she invests in. But the working class black folks in Baltimore typically don't see the things that she's talking about. And it makes me wonder, when she has these community meetings or these community forums, some of which I've been to, like, what real feedback is she getting from folks? And what is her staff telling her about what's going on in Baltimore? And so, you know, especially when she's talking about crime, I mean, the most troubling thing from that speech, when she started talking about, like, black-on-black crime, and the things that black people need to start doing to prevent black-on-black crime, it's like, it's real arrogant to go into that conversation thinking that people in Baltimore aren't already doing that. And at the same time saying that I need to create a new thing that addresses it, when it's like, no, you just need to invest in people that are already doing things in Baltimore already to make it a better place.
So I'm going to come back to this last point you made because it's been one that we've talked about in this program a lot. Mm-hmm. And when I heard the speech or pieces of it the other, last night, Jessel Noor from Real News sent over the video of the whole thing, so I was able to kind of see some of what was going on. We pulled clips from that video, which we're going to play right now. I want to get into that in a very deeper way and have our listeners join us at 410-319-8888. Can we roll a clip? Let's go down the list and roll the clip first on housing, and we'll come back to the issues of crime. The housing vacancy to value clip. Okay, so he's getting that together. It's because they got to pull it up. So, because I think that there are a lot of things here, and one of the things that we talk about a lot on this program around housing, and the mayor's actually coming on this program next month, and I asked her a question that I used in the last hour about transportation, the kind of venerated housing activist, semi-retired now, who's mm-hmm. on the show a great deal, Jeff Singer, came up with this stat that he pulled out of the census data, mm-hmm. and it's a very important stat, I think. I say it over and over again. 86,000 Baltimoreans. 86,000 families in Baltimore. So you multiply that number by four, mm-hmm. or whatever number you want. I don't know what the number would be because I haven't done the analysis. But you have to multiply that number by some. 86,000 families are home insecure, which means 86,000 families in Baltimore are living in poverty and are not sure about where their housing is coming from. Or maybe they're on low poverty, low-wage jobs, and are not making enough money to survive, working two or three jobs. And the kids are the ones who are on the street because their parents are working jobs and have no place for their kids to go. That is never addressed in anybody's speech.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's never addressed. I mean, we talk about workforce housing, building new housing. So we do need workforce housing for social workers, for teachers, for other people who have, you know, moderate wage jobs. But we never talk about half the city of Baltimore, which lives in dire poverty. Mm. What about that?
I mean, one thing that's interesting about economic development and, you know, just economic policy in Baltimore is that we always talk about jobs and the new industry that's coming. Like, there's the casino, there's all this development happening. But the thing is, we don't actually talk about the specifics. So if we're talking about economic development and the wealth that's coming to Baltimore, people that come to Baltimore and increase their wealth typically already have money. And we're not increasing the wealth of the current impoverished citizens or working class citizens in Baltimore, especially black folks. And then when we're talking about economic development generally, like we're talking about like building Harbor Point or new buildings around, you know, around Harbor East and building up those places downtown, those people are getting tax breaks from the citizenry. So so the thing is, the mayor's economic strategy has been to increase the wealth of people who already have money and to attract, I mean, even things in like the Station North Arts District, like it's to attract a white middle class, creative class of folks to make that area more affluent and to displace black people. And so that's been her whole stream of economic policy in Baltimore. And if we're not talking about that specifically, then we're just going to be – on paper, it looks like we have jobs. But jobs for who, economic development for what, in what direction, and what's Baltimore going
to
look like?
What do the jobs pay?
Exactly.
Are you able to sustain yourself, much less save anything, to be able to acquire or get that much closer to the American dream? Mm-hmm. Is it even enough to keep you afloat? The casino jobs are not.
Exactly, exactly.
Right. And I think that touches on the sort of tone of residents taking responsibility, and I think she said that in the context of crime. But people are taking responsibility. People are working really hard. We are just, again, because of the economic policies of the city, not able to make ends meet. I mean, that number that Jeff has, Jeff always has great statistics.
He does.
He just pulls them out of, he's got them everywhere. But, you know, that's a really important statistic. It's also important to note that families are paying way too much for housing, not just that they're, you know, not making enough money. They're also paying a disproportionate amount of their rent to housing. And that's not that they're failing to do their responsibility to work hard and just, you know, try to take care of their families. It's just that there's not there aren't living wage jobs, and the housing market is allowed to go completely out of control.
Let's hear this housing clip, and then I'm going to come right back to play the clips that have to do with what people are focusing on from this speech a lot, which has to do with quote-unquote black-on-black crime and the responsibility of black men. 410-319-8888 is the number here, but let's hear this clip on housing in the speech.
And this year, We will mark the five-year anniversary. When's the party, Paul? The five-year anniversary of our Vacants to Value program. It is an internationally recognized effort that is making a real difference in communities all across our city. I'm particularly proud of how we've leveraged more than $107 million in private investment. Together, we are winning back neighborhoods that were at the tipping point, block by block. Thousands of vacant homes have been demolished or rehabbed so far. And while we're creating housing opportunities for new residents, we're also demonstrating a commitment to those who grew up here. We want to improve your neighborhoods and keep you in the city. Just ask longtime residents like Ms. Janice Jacobs, thank you for being here, who is the president of the Ashland Avenue Association. Just ask her how Vacants to Value has impacted her neighborhood. She describes blocks that were once pocketed with vacant homes, now coming back to life with new investment and new homeowners.
Before we get to the phones, Jessica, you want to comment on that clip? That's your world.
Well, you know, the Vacants to Value program is pretty simple. It's designed for mostly investors. It's not typically an opportunity for first-time homeowners or a way for to create affordable housing. You know, I've been to informational meetings. Mostly the people who are there are investors who want to flip real estate. And that's what the program's designed for. In order to qualify for it, you have to be able to show that you have the capital to turn the house over within a year, which is just completely out of reach.
Based on the estimated by the city cost of rehab.
Yeah.
Because Vacant to Value is only scoped by a new name. That's what the program used to be called under O'Malley. It was selling city-owned property efficiently. They just rebranded it. But it had the same target group. It was not for homeowners. It was not for residents. Mm-hmm. And the estimated cost of rehab was so astronomical, and you couldn't come in with your own contractor and mm-hmm. say, you've estimated $400,000 for this demolition and rehab, but I have someone who can do it for $225,000 and show proof of credit for that, and it wouldn't be accepted. They were the same program. That's why it doesn't work, because they don't really want to sell the property. They just want to look like they want to sell the property
exactly.
to us.
Yeah, and it looks like that's the entire city's affordable housing strategy, mm-hmm. and that's just really, you know, it's very short-sighted. It doesn't work, and, you know, that's all. It just doesn't work.
Well, there used to be in this city a long time ago, though it didn't work as well as it should have. There were community development corporations, like in Park Heights and other places, that actually did this work in Baltimore. And rehabbing houses and buying houses, and that was part of developing to develop a neighborhood and not to just sell to private contractors. And that program was never really allowed to explode. The federal money left and more and else, but that and more. But you have a comment before we hit the phones here, Adam?
I mean, no. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, even just on face, if the Vacants to Value program is like rich white folks come buy our property and flip it, so that way Baltimore can look better. Because the thing is, when you read on the website, like, what are the things that they want the properties to be doing functionally? It's like, you know, at a real fundamental level, it's smart to want to flip your property and get investors involved. But the problem is, like Jessica was saying, it's out of reach. It's out of reach for folks. It's out of reach for the average resident to buy a home like that and to flip it or at least rehab it or make it or, you know, generate a different use for the property. We can't do that because that's not what the city wants. The city wants rich white developers to come in and rehab these properties so that way they can, you know, make their neighborhoods, to gentrify their neighborhoods, to make Baltimore look the way they want it to look in the future.
So let me go to the phones here and get a caller, and then we'll hear these other two clips at 410-319-8888. Justin in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark, and hey, Adam and Kat, Jessica. I just wanted to comment and say that I agree with anyone that says the mayor's comments about black men not doing enough is arrogant and disconnected. Me personally, I've got three jobs. My wife has two. We take care of two kids. And even still, I ask myself, what could I do to reach back? And when I pick my kid up from daycare, I make sure to go around and check every kid's homework. I check their homework. They run up to me. They say, hey, Mr. Gladden, check my homework. I check it, make sure it's right, give them advice. They, you know, it's like, what was she thinking when she said that? You know, I don't think she was really, I don't think she has any clue as to what black men in Baltimore City are doing. And not just myself, but another brother I know named Melvin Cuffey. He's got three kids, no job. Sorry, but I'll keep it short. This is good. I don't understand what you're saying.
That's okay. Justin, it's always good to hear your voice on the show. Go ahead, finish what you were saying.
No problem. Yeah, it's basically just I can't even think of a man that's not doing enough. Bobby Marvin, Melvin Cuffey, mm-hmm. Kieron Kitchen-Walters, mm-hmm. Most of the Black Daddy gang in Baltimore City that I know of have two or three kids, work more than one job, or if they are unemployed, they're consistently looking for work, and they're still reaching back. It almost brought me to tears last night hearing that, and then hearing that people actually consider what she said was smart and intelligent, and then hear someone say that if you're not helping out, you're not a real man. That's in my mind. I have no idea why these people are in office if that's the case. And I'm sure I'm going to get lots of comments on Facebook about it.
Well, Justin, it's really good to hear your voice, and we'll get you on this air as well as a guest because you have a lot to say and you've done a lot. I think can we play these two clips real fast? Mark, can we have them ready? This is directly what he's talking about. And then we're going to come back to James, Pamela, Jay, Harold, Leo, all the people calling in. We're going to get your calls. But let's hear these two clips first.
We know that there can be no public trust without public engagement. We show anger over police misconduct, but far too often, we ignore something that should prompt just as much outrage. Of the 211 tragic killings in our city last year, 189 were African American men. 189. We need to end the violence in our communities. This year on Martin Luther King Day, I, along with many of you, joined a local conversation in support of President Obama's My Brother's Keeper initiative. There was passion and a determination to do more by everyone in the room. I promise to do more. Our African American men need to believe in their future. As many of you know, several years ago, my brother Wendell was a victim of a carjacking.
Okay, so that was the end of those clips. And so I just want to, this is an important place to jump in here, and I think that picking up on what Justin was saying earlier, mm-hmm. and we've had this conversation a lot on this program over this issue of what people are always calling black on black crime. As you pointed out the other day, Adam, we never talk about white on white crime. We don't always talk about black on black crime, and most crime is intra-racial. Though it is exponentially larger percentage-wise in the poorest communities in America, no matter what their racial makeup, mm-hmm. because that's the nature of what poverty does. So I'm just curious what our response is to what the mayor said. I'll let you start this one, Adam. We'll go around to Catalina and then to Jessica.
I mean, generally, I guess...
We get mics.
Generally, I get my general reaction to that is, first off, to say that we need to do one or the other, that we need to either... force police accountability or stop violence in our community. That's a non-starter. There's both. You start with your own community, but there's nothing wrong with stopping police brutality. And the thing is, when I hear that comment, it makes me feel like it makes me reflect on my work because she's calling on black men to step up, and I do both. So I'm like, but where's the check to my organization or to other people to actually fund their work? Because the thing is, it's hard to stop, you know, to stop police brutality or, you know, force police accountability, and to talk about mentoring young people and do all those things with no formal institutional support. And the thing is, it's all political. That's a political minefield, because ultimately, like Catalina said earlier, it's one of those things where she's saying that for political capital. She's not saying that because it's a disingenuous attempt to say that black people need to step up when we are stepping up. Leon Purnell has a men's health center in East Baltimore. That's all these black men that I know personally. I mean, all the black men in Baltimore who are like middle or working class that do this type of stuff, we all know each other. And we all have this. We all have the same conversations over and over again about what we need from the city, or what we need from foundations, or what we need from different places, and we don't get it typically. So we just have to make do, and we generate revenue how we do it, and we do our work every day, day in and day out. So I don't want to hear the mayor chastise me or chastise other black men, because we do it every day. We wake up, we go to bed knowing that we have a profound impact on our community. So to say that is disingenuous. It's not an attempt by her to actually inject herself into the conversation for real, because to say that she needs to start an initiative based on My Brother's Keeper, I don't want to hear that. My Brother's Keeper in general, unless you're writing checks, unless you got some support, you got a resource, you got something I can use, Don't tell me what I need to be doing. You need to step up and stop chastising black men and start actually getting involved in what we're doing and not creating something on your own.
So before I go to the other two guests, let's just very quickly here, because we're pulling these things up, for the My Brother's Keeper clip from the speech last night. It feeds on what you're saying.
I'm announcing the start of an intense focus on our African-American young men. At the end of this month, I will bring together community leaders and experts for a call to action to end African-American homicides. I want to thank Reverend Jamal Harrison Bryan for serving as our moderator for this inaugural forum. Through this call to action, we will recruit men committed to making a difference in the lives of our children, to serve as mentors, volunteers, tutors, job training coaches, speakers, and more. We will reach out to organizations who are already working on this issue, and we will encourage others to join. We will not do it alone. We cannot do it alone. And most importantly, we cannot afford to fail.
So let me start with an editorial comment before I open the phones here and listen to you all, because this is playing off of what you just said, Adam. We cannot do it alone. It might have been stronger, and let you people pick up on this in the studio here, if we had heard people in our city cannot do it alone. We have to help. That's a different mindset than saying, because people are, as you said, we've had, this show's had dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of people from the community, men and women, who are sweating every day to save people's lives and work with young people and try to change things. It's as if they don't exist. It's as if they're not there.
Right. Because they don't know. And they're not writing no checks to support nobody's
It's not
work.
That they don't know. It's that what you all preach and what we know we need in our community is not in line with where they want the city to be.
Exactly.
And who they want in a part of the city when it gets there. Mm-hmm. So it's intentionally disingenuous.
Exactly.
It's intentionally ambiguous so that there's no real plan or framework. It's just an initiative. I hate the word initiative because it gets used so redundantly to mean absolutely nothing.
Exactly.
It is the biggest smoke blower, and the only thing bigger than it might be Beyonce's fan for when she's performing. I mean, like, seriously, this is the serious blowjob of all time. Never, ever. If you hear the word initiative, run. It means they mean nothing. Nothing at all.
Let me open the phones here. Let somebody wants to jump in at 410-319-8888. Let us go to James in Baltimore.
Hey, how you doing?
Good morning, James.
Good. You know, I was just thinking about how the mayor gives away money for tax breaks to developers and stuff like that. But, you know, there's a program that, you know, in my head that I'm thinking she should let people buy these houses for $2,000. They pull all the money together. The city gets $12,000 for the mechanicals. And when they do that, they take the guys that want to learn the trade. They can work with the people doing the electrical, the HVAC. They can work with them. If you do 4 or 5 houses together, and you got 10 or 15 brothers working together, that's what's going to change, because we can get unity, you know, working together. We're not going to get it just mentoring anybody like that. I mean, that's been around for years.
James.
But, you know, when you actually put your foot down and we're working side by side for a common goal, it makes a big difference.
James, what you just raised? I'm sorry. Finish your sentence, and I'll go, jump in. Go ahead. What was your list?
I'm saying, and then the mayor, they had the money because they got billions of dollars from when they sued all those banks a while ago. What are they doing with all that money? They should be giving it back as a tax rebate to the people that want to buy these vacant houses for a couple $1,000s. Put the tax houses on the payroll. And you can get a lot of brothers like me. I'm an electrician. I know a few other mechanical brothers that got licenses and stuff that will help other people, you know, and would do the work for a set price, you know, so somebody's helping to learn them how to do it to move on. I don't understand what you know, why we can't do that. Why we got to give all these big companies these big tax breaks and a little guy that can't get nothing. Can't get no kind of break. We paid for it.
Okay, James, we have to take a break here, but I think you raise a really, 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 really critical issue, I think. And if I hope you can send me an email at marketsteinershow.org, leave your phone number, because I think this kind of stuff you're talking about is where we have to go. We had a quick break here. We're going to come right back. I want to tackle what he said. And Pamela and Mary, you are the next two callers up. We're going to come to your calls as soon as we return as well. And as we're going to break, you're hitting, oh, my God, we're going to play this song now? Is that it? Otis Redding? Yes, it is. Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Hit gold in 1968 on this day, 3 months after we lost Otis Redding in a plane crash. So we'll be right back.
Then I watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and of course that's Teach Your Children, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, from their album Deja Vu, which was released on this day in 1970. And we are here with Catalina Byrd, co-host of No Hooks for the Hip Hop Chronicles here on WEAA, and a media consultant and political strategist, Adam Jackson, CEO of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, Jessica Lewis, housing organizer at the Right to Housing Alliance, and you at 410-319-8888. But let's pick up before we go to Pamela and then Mary. So you two, please hold on. We're going to come right to your calls as soon as we tackle this one piece right here, which is that what he was saying was basically that we did something in a different creative way, starting a working kind of co-op where men and women with skills can rehab and build these houses and turn them into places for people to live, come up with a different way of doing things, talking about microloans. Really, this is a different kind of microloan, and putting these men to work and creating community, because we can mentor all the people we want all day long, but without jobs, all the mentoring in the world is not going to solve the issues that half of our city faces.
Yeah, I mean the rubber hits the road with that, the mayor of Baltimore does not support creative black entrepreneurship, you know, and that's something I have personal experience with, because when we're talking about those types of ideas, I know plenty of black men that talk about those ideas, or just black people that have those types of ideas, and I'm confused, like, why don't they immediately get support? Because that sounds like something that if you give it a little bit of support financially, you would get a lot of return, and then you can eventually see it grow over time. But the problem is, you know, Mayor Stephanie Marlins Blake is not creative. She is not interested in black entrepreneurship and increasing our ability to thrive in Baltimore as residents of Baltimore, people that grew up here. Because that's one of the, as I'm getting older, I'm like, why would I want to stay? As a person that's from here, like, what is the investment in our entrepreneurial prowess? And it's not, and there's no investment. And so you need, like you said, you need to give people jobs and economic opportunities and to give them a chance to harness their entrepreneurial spirit. But there's, like we were talking about earlier, it's disingenuous. That's not the direction Baltimore wants to go. We want to be D.C. We want to be gentrified. We don't want working class black people to live here. We want to attract a creative class of middle class white people to take over the central parts of Baltimore, so that way we can have a city that looks more like D.C. That's now, you know, it's becoming more and more gentrified. So that's not the direction Baltimore is going in.
Let me get Jessica to jump in, and then over to Catalina, and then back to the phones.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think that's the whole tone of the whole speech, the whole tone of not just this particular, like, mayoral administration, but the city in general, is that it's essentially, this is not going to be a city for poor people. This is not going to be a city for working class people. This is going to be a city that we're going to bring in all new. We're going to build new infrastructure strictly for new people. We see it in housing all the time. Like, you know, we have a really broken rent court. 7,000 families get evicted every year. That stays about the same. You know, we see lots of new money, lots of city money going to big, high price infrastructure, high price housing. We don't see, you know, a lot of money coming in to support public housing. You know, we have a statewide Affordable Housing Community Land Trusts Act. We don't have any funding for affordable housing community land trusts. We just don't see the city spending priorities to provide housing infrastructure for poor and working class people the way that we see tax money going to infrastructure for.
And that's intentional, because what this machine and whomever the architects of this design are clearly trying to do is change what Baltimore has been historically. We've always been a blue-collar town. And some of that camaraderie that James was talking about, the caller that we had before the break, it came from the fact that there were, like, only three or four major employers in the city, and we had all worked together. But the other part that I don't hear discussed as much that kind of bothered me so much, even more so than saying black men be accountable for black men, is My Brother's Keeper and all of these initiatives that focused on black men, while the growing statistic of black women in prisons girls are black mm-hmm. women mm-hmm. and black girls are being lost in this rhetoric, and we can't afford to allow that to happen, and we need the black men who are like Adam and that are in Justin and who are in their communities doing things, making sure that they're honoring their wives and their sisters and their mothers and lifting us up as well.
Right.
Because we're lost in the national conversation about it.
Look, Jackie just wrote an email in about that, which I'm going to read, but let me go to the phones first. So I'm thinking of women and get some women in this conversation, more women in this conversation as well. 410-319-8888. Pamela in Bolton Hill, you're on the air.
When I first called, you were talking about housing.
Yes.
And one of the housing statistics is about the seniors. Mm. The seniors own these houses, and they are not being given any assistance. Everything is, if you come to us, you can apply. But the seniors are stuck in their houses. They have low housing values, high taxes. And programs that are set, the few programs that are set up for the seniors, doesn't, you know, since people are getting older and older every day, doesn't address the people who have to stay in their houses and can't get assistance. And it's, I go around to their houses, and it's just amazing how many are on the verge of losing their houses to tax sale, water bills that are put in tax sale, everything that's been recently talked about, but it's been going on for years.
Mm-hmm.
And especially up in, you know, well, everybody around, they own their houses, they're proud to own their houses, but they're not told how to prevent people from taking their houses from them for a $300 water bill.
Pamela, go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
Okay. Well, anyway, but... I'm going to stop there because I could talk about seniors all day.
Well, I'd love to hear more of you talk. I'd like to hear you talk more about that one day on this program, because I think that, Jessica, this is one of the things that we don't talk about, what Pamela's bringing to us, our attention about housing, and the fact that we don't often realize the numbers of especially African-American senior citizens in the city who own their homes and are losing them in too large a number.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that the city does strategically, and they do this as part of the Vacants to Value program and is how they get, you know, the city ends up owning a housing stock, is that they can aggressively target certain areas for code violations, code enforcement, for tax liens, things like that, and end up acquiring these houses because, again, like senior citizens who aren't necessarily, you know, capable of mowing a lawn will get slapped with a code violation that they then can't afford to pay. They'll get – and they're targeted strategically in certain areas for this, specific areas for code enforcement violations. And that's a mechanism for the city to acquire those homes.
Also, the orphans court and unclaimed property, people not understanding that even if your loved one passes without a will, that you still have a window to go and claim that property as their heir. And we've not taught generational wealth, especially in poor communities, and we don't understand how to maintain that which our grandparents worked so hard at Bethlehem Steel and others to purchase and give us our memories in.
And a lot of those houses are right next to vacants, so they can't get insurance to insure the house if something goes wrong.
Right.
That's the other piece of it. Mm-hmm. Let me go back to the phones here, then we'll come right back to our panel. 410-319-8888. Mary in Towson, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Hi,
Mary.
What a great program.
Thank you.
I'm not saying anything new, but if to couple with the woman who just spoke about senior housing, it's institutionalized racism, and, mm-hmm. you know, I'm a white woman from the county, but I tutor in Baltimore City. This young boy that I was tutoring, they were closed out of their housing on North Avenue and given a voucher. A voucher for what? The boy now is no longer attending school, missing out on this tutoring opportunity. But I want to say one more thing, and that's we can't fight the anger and violence in the city until we have a living wage that's commensurate with the cost of living, decent housing. When we use the debt ceiling as an excuse, that it is just that, an excuse. And with that, I'll just listen.
Mary, thanks so much. And on my back to the panel, let me read this email from Jackie, if I might, because it fits into what the callers were saying, and it also fits into what Catalina was observing just a few minutes before we went to the phones. Yesterday, we found out that one of our young women is HIV positive. This is Jackie Robarge, who works with women in the city. She's homeless and has no high school diploma and has a criminal record. We have watched her brilliance and promise be stamped out year after year. Like the mayor, she too is a quote-unquote Baltimore girl through and through. But in Baltimore, we have done very little since she was a child to prevent her from becoming HIV positive because we have neglected her brilliance, the abuse she has experienced, and the barriers we put up to in education, housing, and employment. Why do we wait until black women find themselves at absolute bottom to get a hand up, if at all? Do we expect women to continue to struggle financially, saddled with debt, criminal backgrounds, limited education, employment, substandard housing, on top of caring for an extended families? To continue to divest in the well-being and equality of girls of color has had a devastating effect on Baltimore. The mayor's speech left out 50% of the communities of color, their needs, their strengths, and their contributions, the impact of violence on the lives of women, those that are primary caretakers of our children, and I can't understand why. So I think that's, coupled with what you were saying, is a very powerful statement of what we're missing here.
Well, the statistics have proven it's not just here in Baltimore. The growing population inside the penal system is black women. And in understanding, and I'm not usually one, I leave that touting to Adam, who study it more, but if you look at it from an institutional racism standpoint, when a woman gives birth to a child while she's in prison, the child automatically becomes state custody. As a result, is not able to be a part of the family unit or even have the opportunity to know what that feels like. And that begins the trajectory of excuses to raise taxes because the state has to house this child and the state has to do this. And if you've ever worked with any of these children, if you've ever mentored and been here, the things that the state provides, the wards of the state, is not any better than what someone living in Section 8 can provide getting social services. So we have failed them, and we've been failing them for some time, and now we are looking back at it, and hindsight is 20/20, but the problem exists. And if we're just starting to look like black men, where will black women be by the time they come around to look at us too?
Yeah, I mean, and just to talk about it from a historical standpoint, I mean, the social services as an intermediary between the black family is something that's steeped in institutional racism. Because the one thing that it does, we rely on the state to break up our families. I mean, and the thing is, when we talk about like food stamps and all these other things that we rely on, it's not based in anything sustainable that keeps the black family together. It's things that we have to rely on the government for, and it doesn't enhance our ability to nation build or build each other. Build ourselves up in the process. And so that's a thing that's kind of missing out of most of like elected official speeches or rhetoric, is that we're not talking about ways that we can make the community sustainable on our own without the intermediary of the government or social services. Because you're absolutely right, Catalina, we need to be talking about black girls as well. Black boys are not the only focus, because the thing is, the entire family has been disrupted, and we can't use a political ploy by Barack Obama as an excuse to say that black men need to stand up. It needs to be a bigger effort in Baltimore generally to support the grassroots folks who are doing work in our communities to make our communities more sustainable.
And as you've said before, just you can jump here as well, and we'll go right back to the phones, is that, and I want to say this over and over again, because people have to hear it, that black men and women have been standing up.
Exactly.
They have to be supported and recognized for that standing up, support those programs that exist that work with young people and give them the funds and resources necessary to do the work. And as our caller called in earlier, the idea of starting workers' co-ops in Baltimore to rebuild these houses with unemployed men and women being able to do the job and giving the homes to people who need it is a different way of looking at what we can do with our housing stock. And it doesn't mean we don't – that the millennials and anybody else want to come in and live here. That's fine. But it's not just about that.
Right.
It's about more than that.
I'm sorry. My bad.
Oh, no. Continue, because I was going to jump back to the what we were talking about earlier. So go ahead.
Oh, I was just trying to clarify in terms of when people say support, because I feel like that's a real nebulous term that people use especially when we're talking about programmatic things. I mean support like money. I mean support
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So if the mayor and I talking about here's the cash, then shut your mouth. I don't want to hear the rhetoric around supporting the efforts. Like, yeah, cool. Thanks for the speech. Thanks for the rhetoric. I appreciate like inviting me to the meeting. But
no,
where's the check?
There are dozens of groups who are doing the work. They need the support, is what I'm saying. That's what I mean.
So I just wanted to make a comment about the connection between, you know, women. women in housing and incarceration. A study came out last year, I think, by this guy Matthew Desmond. I think the MacArthur Foundation put it out. Uh-huh. It's a study that relates rates of incarceration of black women to rates of eviction of black women to rates of incarceration of black men. And I think the two are really, you know, really intricately and closely related, as Jackie knows through her work at The Power Inside. And I think that's really, really important to recognize that, and the connection between housing and incarceration in black communities. And if you lay down a census map of lay down a map of where people are incarcerated from, like where they're from and where vacant properties are, they're essentially the same map. It's really, really,
and we have to really educate our community. So, we have got to stop being afraid of the census. The Warrant Commission, the parole and probation is not looking at the census. And the reason when we don't participate, coupled with just out of hysteria, paranoia, coupled with mass incarceration, what we don't understand is that the census tells certain people who are never going to be on the front lines of the work where people live. And so those counties that house those prisons get investment and they don't have nearly as many people in population as we do, but we are afraid and have been stigmatized because of so many different dynamics of institutional racism and how it's come down. We've got to stop being afraid of the census. They have to know that we're here for those of us who have always been saying we need the resources to justify it, because we look at a map and we know how many people really live there because we're out there, but the map is not reflecting it because we're not participating.
Mm-hmm. So, folks, can I speak? That's what I do for a living. Sometimes I can't get it out.
Use your words, Mark.
All right, here we go. To the phones before we have to take a break and go to the city paper. 410-319-8888 is the number. Harold in Baltimore County, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Harold.
You know, I want to say something in reference to this. And you may know the individual I speak of, Bernie McCain, who hosted a popular radio show in the D.C. area, once said, if you want to see what's happening in Baltimore, look at what's happening in D.C., the gentrification of what happened in D.C. And to his credit, Marion Barry got it right. He said, if you want to do business in my town, you're going to support the people who live in this town. Now, we know D.C. had the reputation of Chocolate City, and I commend the mayor from the standpoint, if you want to do business in town, you need to contribute something to the town. But she should also carve out a bigger piece of that pie. If you want to do business in town, not only are you going to do business and contribute to the city, but you're also going to contribute to the minority population here, i.e. the gentleman that's on your show. There should be some set aside for those types of organizations, for companies who want to come in and do business in the Baltimore City area, if the issue is a lack of funding. If I represent ABC Corporation, I want to come into Baltimore and set a corporate headquarters up, that's great. However, you want to also contribute to funding these organizations that exist.
Harold, thanks so much for your call and for holding on. I think that you mentioned Marion Barry's name, and I knew Marion Barry way, way, way back in the day from SNCC time, and because of what he stood up for, that's why, even though he was indicted and got all this stuff that happened, is why he was reelected
by the people.
Because he was the people's mayor and always stood up for what people needed. Mm-hmm. And we all have our foibles. I raised my hand first. So so this is closing thoughts before we have to – very quick closing thoughts before we have
well,
to –
Well, what Harold was saying is, I did run for mayor. So one of the things in 2011 that was a big part of my platform was only giving tax breaks to those who had hired from actual Baltimore citizenry. I also wanted to, and I knew I would get pushback from the council, was a nonviolent ex-offender hiring quota. If you come to Baltimore, if you do business in Baltimore, then at least 2% of your employees, if you have 50 or more, should be nonviolent ex-offenders from the city who are coming back. And I'd like to see whomever is next in line or this in this administration take that approach.
Very quickly, Jessica, and then Jessica Lewis, then over to Adam Jackson.
I'm going to bring it back to housing again. Kind of a one-trick pony today.
That's okay. It's an important trick.
We have The highest volume court in the city is rent court that deals with failure to pay rent cases. It's 150,000 people a year going through that court. We are still leading the nation statewide in foreclosures. It's higher in the city. And we have, you know, we're selling off our public housing to private companies. We really need to have an affordable housing plan, and we don't have one. The city and the city does not seem to care at all about low-income housing, and I think that that's reflected in the mayor's speech and the sort of lack of vision in both the Housing Authority and Office of Human Services.
Wrap it up, Adam Jackson.
I guess I'll just speak to the issue of crime in the mayor's speech. If the mayor is interested in decreasing crime in Baltimore and making it a more inhabitable place for people who live here and for people who want to come here, she needs to invest in the grassroots organizations and individuals who are doing work in the Baltimore community to make it a better place to live. You cannot attract new residents, keep people here, if you do not invest in the places you say you want to be stabilized and to be, you know, good places to be. So if the mayor wants to do that, she needs to invest. Otherwise, I don't want to hear her mouth.
So Adam Jackson has been joining us along with Catalina Byrd and Jessica Lewis. Thank the three of you for your activism in the community and for being on this program today. If I were mayor of Baltimore, in response to the mayor's State of the City speech, good to have the three of you with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, on the way, this very quick break, I want to remind you to write to Valerie, V-A-L-E-R-I-E, at steinershow.org. If you're interested on March the 19th from 7 to 9 p.m., to be part of our focus group to make sound bites, our look at food, our food system, a better program. We want to hear your thoughts on that. If you write to her, we have dinner, you'll meet the staff, and help us make the Mark Steiner Show and that segment a better segment. We're going to take a very brief break, and on our way to break, we are hearing what? The Grapevine by the Stilts. On this day in 1979, the Stilts, who were the first all-female punk band, made their debut in London. We'll be right back. Stay with us with what's happening in this week's City Paper.